Second Samuel. This is the return of the Jedi to the Empire Strikes Back of 1 Samuel. The cliffhanger was that Saul's dead, Jonathan's dead, David's in exile, Philistines are all over the place. It's terrible. And in chapter 1, which we're going to skip over, David mourns for Saul and for Jonathan, his buddy. And because Saul, the king, is dead, there is a geopolitical power vacuum where everyone is, you know, vying for power. The Philistines, the Ammonites, well, David actually beat them away, but there's also the heir to the throne, Ishbosheth. He is the remaining son of King Saul. So he feels like, I should be on the throne. David's like, nah, I'm supposed to be the one. So there's all this like political intrigue, revenge, assassinations. It's like a Game of Thrones episode. It is so good. Really should read it, but for whatever reason, I'm going to skip over it. So David is made the king. He is in power. Ishbosheth is dead. Saul is dead. Everyone's dead except for David. All right, he comes right up to the top, and he is king. We read in the first verse of chapter 5, the tribes of Israel came from far and wide to David at Hebron, and they said to him, "We are your own flesh and blood." This was a prerequisite to be the king of Israel. Deuteronomy 17, verse 15, said that you had to be an Israelite to be the king. And truly, to be a leader, you need to be with the other people around you. So this seems like this would have some application and implication for us today. They said, "In the past, while Saul was king over us, you were the one who led Israel on their military campaigns." Remember that? Saul was always out there hunting David like a hunter, hunting a partridge, whatever metaphor he used. But David was the one actually fighting the Philistines. He was the guy actually doing the work, which would be another application and implication of leadership. Not that you're the leader du jour. That's a leader legally, by name. But you're the leader de facto. You're the true leader, the acting leader. That was David. And I've had people come to me and say, "Well, when am I going to be made a leader?" I'm like, no one's made a leader. We are recognized as leaders in this church. We see who is leading. And the people who are leading, we're trying to watch and see who are the leaders. So they said, "That was you the whole time. We could see you were the true leader here. And the Lord was the one who said to you, 'You will shepherd my people Israel and you will become their ruler.'" So it doesn't hurt to have a calling either as a leader. Very much, it's very much the case that when you serve God and you're put into a position of some kind of influence and, you know, trying to impact people, to know that it wasn't people that put you there, but it was God who was the one who put you in that role. Very powerful, very settling to your heart to know this is where God has me, where he wants me. Well, verse 3, "When all the elders of Israel had come to King David at Hebron, the king made a covenant or an agreement with them before the Lord, and they anointed David king over Israel." So this means he's the age of 30. We're going to see that in the subsequent verse. He was anointed about the age of 15. God said, "You are the next king of Israel." And yet, there was a span of time, half of his life up until this point, where he knew he was the king, but he wasn't recognized as the king. Which seems to me to be another implication for us today. When we can sense that God has a calling, we can know that he has a calling for my life, but we don't know when. And we would do well not to try and control that either, to try and expedite that process or slow it down, either way. But just to let God be God and let him do the work in his timing, in his way. David was 30 when he became king, and he reigned 40 years. In Hebron, he reigned over Judah for 7.5, and in Jerusalem, he reigned over all Israel and Judah for 33 years. King David and his men marched to Jerusalem to attack the Jebusites who lived there. Whoa, what happened here? Well, he needs his capital. He's been in Hebron. That's not really the central place. And Jerusalem is really, it's kind of like the Washington, D.C. of Israel. It's not quite in the north. It's not quite in the south. It wasn't really developed. This would be a good place to bring together Israel and Judah together. Why is he attacking these innocent, poor Jebusites, you ask? Precisely because they are neither innocent nor poor. These people are evil and wicked people. I just taught a course on this very subject, the killing of the Canaanites. What was that all about? These people worshipped Baal. That was their god. And Baal, their god, was a fertility god. And in their myths, Baal raped his sister Ashereth, and she was in the form of a calf at the time. They could change their shape. So she shapeshifted into a calf. He raped her 77 times in their myths. So there you have the trifecta. You have rape, incest, and bestiality. And this is their god, the Jebusites' god. So, like God, like worshiper. If your god is performing rape, bestiality, and incest, what are you going to do as the worshiper? They had ritual prostitution. They had infant sacrifice, where they would burn kids on the altar of Kronos, one of the gods. They would superheat the god's hands and then throw the babies onto the hands, and they would just sizzle and burn. We have this excavated in our sources to this very day. These people, why did they get killed? Why did God choose to kill these people? I'll tell you why. They deserved death. That's why. They deserved to die. And if you don't believe that they deserve to die, I would like to know what does deserve death. If it's not ritual prostitution and it's not burning kids at the age of 6 months, I would like to know what does deserve death. In this case, they deserved judgment. At this point, the Israelites had been trying to take over the city of Jerusalem for generations. I mean, we're going back to the time of Joshua, 1400 BC. This is David. This is now in 1000 BC, 400 years, longer than the United States has been a country. They've been trying to take over Jerusalem, and they've been getting rebuffed over and over and over. And when they get there, what do they find? These really contrite Jebusites, oh, we're so sorry for all the evil, wicked things that we're doing. No, they're saying, you're not going to get in here, David. Even the blind and the lame can ward you off. So they're mean toward blind and lame people also. We'll add that to the list. And they thought to themselves, David can't get in here. They can't. I mean, they've been trying for 400 years, so they're just looking down at David just like, you know. Well, on the day of the attack, David said to his troops, I hate those lame and blind Jebusites. It's not that he hates the disabled. We're going to see there's a disabled man, Mephibosheth, in chapter 9 that he takes care of. He's using their language against them. Whoever attacks them should strike by going into the city of Jerusalem through the tunnel. The tunnel? The tunnel. The water tunnel. We have excavated this. This was discovered by Charles Warren. It's called the Warren Tunnel. And if you see here, I really geeked out on this. I don't know why, but I did. There's this tunnel that goes under the city of Jerusalem. In this part here is a 49-foot drop. So, during a time of siege, when you couldn't go out to get your water from the Gihon Spring, you'd be dehydrated, you'd die within a few days. So, they could send people through the secret tunnel, and they could put their bucket down this tunnel, and they could get the water out, and nobody knew the wiser. So, how are they getting water? Because this natural spring was coming through. So, these people would go down, get their water every single time, until one of David's men was reconnoitering this whole land, spying it out, and he's just like, what's in this tunnel? Huh? Hey, 49 feet, that's not that bad. And he climbs it, goes into the city, opens up the doors, and David's men just come right through the front door. Oh, man. Love it. Water tunnel. Yeah, we got it. The Warren Tunnel, look it up. Well, David then took up residence in the fortress. He called it, very modestly, the City of David. He built up the area around it from the terraces inward. We've got this as well. The site from the 14th century BC, which is, you know, before this point, was only about 12 acres. David expands the footprint of Jerusalem. And we can see where this was unfolded in the archaeological strata. And David became more and more powerful. Why? Because the Lord God Almighty was with him. Yeah. Chapter 6. David's got his city. He's got his kingship. He's on the throne. There's only one thing left. He wants that ark, the Ark of the Covenant. We need the ark, baby. So David again brought together all the able young men of Israel, 30,000 of them. That's a lot of men. He led them to Bala of Judah to bring back the ark of God. In case you weren't with us when we studied this in the book of Exodus, there was the tabernacle, which was basically like a big tent. We're going to return to this next week. But essentially, this was a big tent in which there were all of these sacred objects. The high priest, the bread of the presence, the altar of incense, the golden lampstand, and, in particular, the Ark of the Covenant. Maybe you've seen the movie Indiana Jones, where they have the Ark of the Covenant. Yeah, that's where this is from. They got it from Indiana Jones. All right. This whole thing, this idea that you had an ark and poles and the cherubim, a cherub is an angel, this whole thing was a picture of what God was doing in and through his program of forgiveness. So David's like, I want that back. The problem is, it had been missing, not missing so much. It had been squandered out in the house of Abinadab for 60 years. And King Saul was so unspiritual, he didn't want anything to do with this thing. He was kind of afraid of it. And he wasn't into God, so for 60 years, longer than David's been alive, the Ark of the Covenant's been out in the middle of nowhere. So he's like, we got to get this back. So they go up there to Abinadab's house. This is one of David's brothers, we find out. They sent the Ark of God on a new cart. Remember that. They put the Ark on a new cart. Wait, in that sexy drawing I just drew for you, they're putting it on a cart. Everyone, no one laughed at sexy drawing? That's hilarious. It's not that funny. All right, so they put it on a cart instead of on poles where they're supposed to carry it. They put it on a new cart. Oh, that's smart. And they brought it from the house of Abinadab, his brother, which was on the hill. Uzzah and Ahio, sons of Abinadab, were guiding the new cart with the Ark of God on it. David and all Israel were energetically celebrating before the Lord, singing and playing various stringed instruments, tambourines, rattles they had, and cymbals. When they came to the threshing floor of Nacon, Uzzah reached out and took hold of the Ark of God because the oxen kind of stumbled. Uzzah, why would you do that? You're not supposed to touch the Ark. You're not supposed to have it on a cart. This whole picture is wrong. The motive is right. We got to get the ark back, but they're doing it all wrong. And it just kind of teeter-totters, and Uzzah reaches out to stop it. The Lord's anger burned against Uzzah because of his irreverent act. Therefore, God struck him down, and he died there beside the ark of God. So the music is playing. The band is in full force. They're celebrating 30,000 men. Then all Israel shows up, and they look over at Uzzah. Somebody checks his pulse. He's dead. Whew. Silence. And at this point, the entire party just comes to a bracing halt. Then David was angry because the Lord's wrath had broken out against Uzzah. Apparently, he was angry at God. Why did you do that? I'm trying to serve you here. I'm trying to get the ark, and you kill the guy that's carrying it. David was afraid of the Lord that day, and he said, how can the ark of the Lord ever come to me? Why is it that God is so severe in this instance? Well, I got a few thoughts. To begin, the severity should relate to the importance of the thing that we are discussing. The severity would relate to the flippancy with which they were moving this sacred object. How important is the ark? You know, imagine I was helping you move, you know, from your apartment or your house to a new location. And, you know, one of your paintings is sitting there and I see this, you know, junky thing, you know, and what should I do with it? I grab it, try and fit it into my trunk, I guess. I don't really have a big trunk. All right, I'll bungee it to the top of my car, you know, or I don't know what we'll do with it. Can we throw it out? No, that'll leave too much trash behind the house, you know, so eventually, I'm just like, what do we even do with this thing? And I come to discover that this is a Jackson Pollock number 17A. Jack the Dripper, as my art teacher used to say. Okay, this is worth $250 million. I know I don't get abstract art either. I don't like it. I've never liked Jackson Pollock. I think he is a terrible person. But Apparently, people will pay $250 for this. Now, that whole picture of me shoving this thing into my trunk and bungeeing it to the top of my car because I don't want to like actually do the work of moving this invaluable piece of art down to your new apartment. Okay, there's something just fundamentally wrong with that picture. Why? Because the greater of importance that you place on this piece of art, the more gently and thoughtfully you should treat it. How much more, therefore, should they have been treating this priceless, invaluable object that God had given to them in the Ark of the Covenant? Truly, God had warned the priests. He said, if you touch any of the sacred objects, you will die. So it's like any of them. And then the Ark, yeah, definitely the Ark. If you're going to touch any of the sacred objects, if it's the Ark, you've got to go through this routine. That's a teaching for another day. But the Ark is incredibly important in God's program. The Levites, as I said, were supposed to carry the Ark with poles. They basically stuck these poles through the Ark in its side, and then they would carry it. So they were being lazy. We're going to put it onto a beast of burden, onto a cart, and then the ox will take it, or the oxen, they will take it, and eventually it'll make its way. And of course, it stumbles, and then Uzzah reaches out. But here's the kicker. The Ark didn't fall. It didn't fall. It just nearly was upset. So Uzzah reaches out. Think of the precedent that would set. If he reaches out, they're doing everything all wrong, and then he stabilizes it, and it didn't fall. Even if it did fall, let's say it does fall, the ground, the dirt, is less sinful than Uzzah's hand. Uzzah is the sinner, not the ground. So for him to reach out, this was just completely profane, and God was setting a precedent. You do not do this. You do not screw around with things that I've given to you like this. Well, David gets completely gun-shy at this point. He wasn't willing to take the Ark of the Lord to be with him in the city of David. Instead, he took it to the house of Obed-Edom, the Gittite. He's from Gath. The Ark of the Lord remained in the house of Obed-Edom, the Gittite, for 3 months, and the Lord blessed Obed-Edom and his entire household. So apparently, he was good to have it. Well, King David hears about this. The Lord has blessed the house of Obed-Edom and everything he has because of the Ark. God is not upset, okay? He's not angry or anything. It's just, you screwed up. You were zealous, you had the right motive, but you had the wrong method. And so David's like, let's go get that ark. So he goes to Obed-Edom, and he's going to bring the ark to the city of David with rejoicing. When those who were carrying the ark of the Lord had taken 6 steps, 1, 2, 3, 6, they take 6 steps, and David's like, stop, stop. And everyone looks at David, what on earth, what's going on? Did Uzzah die again or something? They all look at him. And David's just like, we've got to throw a party, okay? So he pulls out a bull and a fattened calf, and he kills it, and he sacrifices it. And they're just like, oh, yeah, it's on, man. So they're like excited, and the music starts to play again. It's been 60 years since this thing has been in the hands of the Israelites. He can't make it 6 steps until he's like, we've got to celebrate this. Wearing a linen ephod, that's like a robe, essentially. Linen, like real breathable, so it must have been pretty nice or whatever. David was dancing before the Lord with all his might. The Hebrew there is literally whirling, okay? With all his might, dancing. So it's like that guy at the concert, you know, when you go to the concert, every concert with his shirt off, and he's just kind of like dancing around. He's always right in front of you, and you're like, can you just sit down? Can you sit down, please? If we just all sit down, we can see Taylor Swift play, all right? You just sit down. And he's dancing around. David, I don't know what he's doing. He's dancing around. I can't dance, but he's dancing around, whirling. Like, probably, here's my guess. All right? He's probably arm in arm with his other Israelites. Bar mitzvahs for boys, bat mitzvahs for girls today. The dancing is actually something I can get into. It's you arm in arm, and you go around in a circle and run around with each other. It's super fun. And you put the you ever go to a Jewish wedding, you put the groom up on the chair, and you lift him up, and we're dancing around. It's super awesome. Anyways, this was 3,000 years ago. I don't know if that's how they did it. But he's dancing with all these guys. He's having a blast, and he's got breathable robes on, and he's just having a great time. You know what I mean? and David and all Israel were bringing up the Ark of the Lord with shouts and the shouts of trumpets. The music is back in full force. As the Ark of the Lord was entering the city of David, Michal, daughter of Saul, watched from a window. Everyone's down there on the ground dancing, having a great time. They're just singing and sweating and drinking and eating and laughing and having Michal sitting there looking down. And when she saw King David leaping and dancing before the Lord, she despised him in her heart. They brought the Ark of the Lord and set it in its place inside the tent that David had made for it, and David sacrificed burnt offerings and fellowship offerings before the Lord. After he had finished sacrificing the burnt offerings and fellowship offerings, he blessed the people in the name of the Lord. Then he gave a loaf of bread, a cake of dates, and a cake of raisins to each person in the whole crowd of Israelites, both men and women. Like, I've never been in a bar when this has happened, but I've seen lots of movies where it's happened, where somebody's like, all right, drinks on the house, and everyone's like, yay. Like, David's like, date cakes for everybody, and they're like, yay. Cakes of raisins galore, and everyone's eating, it's great. And all the people went home to their homes, they're happy. And David went home to his home to pronounce a blessing on his house to his wonderful wife. But Michal, Saul's daughter, came out to meet him. He's having the best day of his life, man. And his terrible wife comes out. She says to him, how the king of Israel has distinguished himself this very day. He has exposed himself before the servant girls the way a vulgar fool might do. Whoa, that's a charge there with all that whirling around. We don't know what was happening inside that ephod. So David said to Michal, how's he going to respond? So yeah, that's what you think? No, actually, that whole thing, what was it all about? That was all before the Lord. That's what that was about. God chose me rather than your dad or anyone from your house when he appointed me ruler over the Lord's people in Israel. And yes, I will celebrate before the Lord. This is not good for a marriage, I'm just saying, but like, this is a good comeback, like really good comeback. Then he says, I will become even more undignified than this, and I will be, literally in the Hebrew, humbled in my own eyes. But by these slave girls you spoke of, I will be held in honor. And Michal, daughter of Saul, had no children to the day of her death. So, what's that mean? She is totally out of the dynasty, because she can't have kids. And so, Saul's line is gone. That's it. What do we learn? What do we learn about loving God with all of our heart, our passion, our emotion from this particular passage? Well, to begin, was it strange for David to show emotion for God? No doubt he did show emotion. I mean, he had a rich emotional life. He's showing anger. He's showing fear. He's showing joy. He's dancing. He's leaping. He's shouting. He's throwing parties. I mean, this guy was somebody you would want to be around. Read the Psalms, 73 of which are written by David, and he's just pouring out his heart nonstop. This was a man with a rich emotional life. Isn't that kind of weird? Like, shouldn't David kind of restrain himself a little bit? Like, with all the dancing and the whirling and the moving around and, you know, dude, I mean, that's a little bit fanatical. That's a little bit kind of bizarre. Don't you know you're making people uncomfortable with showing so much emotion? And not being a stoic, of course, you know what I mean? But at least could you just be a little bit normal, David? No, that's not strange to express emotion for the Lord. You're strange. I'm strange. We're the strange ones here. We're the weird ones. You know, when you see an athlete, you know, winning the finals, I don't know, World Series, Super Bowl, you know, these hyper-masculine, manly men just weeping tears of joy or sorrow. And nobody looks at that and says, oh, how strange. Why? Why? Because they're doing something very important. That's why. They're doing something so important that they're weeping because their heart was in it. That's why. Indeed, it would be strange if one of the players on those teams wasn't weeping. Why? Because it meant precisely the fact that their heart wasn't in it. So we see this in other areas of life. We see people show lots of emotion in other areas, except when it comes to God, the summum bonum, the greatest conceivable good, the one who's given us eternal life, the one who has sacrificed his son, Jesus Christ, to show his great love for us. That is where we say, no, that would be kind of strange to show any kind of emotion. I would say it's actually incredibly strange to be stoic when we're talking about the greatest thing we've ever heard or could ever hear about, eternal life, knowing God, experiencing a love relationship with God, to have your life infused with objective, eternal significance and purpose. That would be something over which we could genuinely get emotional. When we read our Bibles, we see that God actually commands us to be emotional. This is a command for those of you who are stoic. You know, you can't get an expression out of you. You're cold. You're icy. Let me put this on your conscience. That is a sin, to be a cold, icy, unemotional person. Well, no, that's just the way I am. That's just the way I was raised. You know, that's just my personality. No, your personality needs to change. You're a Christian now. And look at Jesus. Look at Jesus just blubbering with tears at the tomb of Lazarus. Happy, looking at people's faith, just amazed, so excited to see people growing with God, angry at evil. I mean, Jesus had a full, rich, emotional life. And we are too as well. Rejoice with those who rejoice, says Paul in Romans chapter 12, verse 15. When is the last time it wasn't about you, but somebody else, and they were rejoicing and they were happy, and you were rejoicing for them? Rejoice with those who rejoice. When was the last time someone was weeping and you shed a tear? This is a command in the Bible to be tender-hearted, forgiving those. Can it get weird expressing emotion? Oh yeah, it can get weird. I've seen it get weird. Okay, I've had to say to some people, dude, okay, every week at our small group, you're crying. Get a grip, okay? You don't need to cry every time we see you, you know? Anyways, this can get weird, but is that what was happening with David? No. See, he was showing emotion commensurate with what was happening. The ark was coming back into town. That's the time when you start whirling and dancing and giving out free food and singing and having music and partying. Now, if something like that wasn't happening, we don't see that in David. But this is the time to express some emotion. Of course it's the time. So no, it wasn't strange. We're the weird culture here. We are the strange ones. Not what we're reading here. Not at all. Now, at this point, I feel like I'm probably preaching to the choir. People know, okay, I should be more emotional. You know, I should be able to show my emotions. Not just, you know, I do love you, but I show it. I know that. But how do you do it? It feels so fakey. And I hate that fakey, phony thing where it's just this fraudulent love. And we know it. People are smart. They can tell the difference between real expressions of love and false. So maybe we should just wait until it feels real before we show the emotion. No. There are things that we can do to actually get emotion. For one, we can actually look at how God's promises are being fulfilled. See, David saw God anoint him as king over Israel. That was 15 years before that promise was made. And now he's on the heels of that, and he's realizing, God, you took me through the woods and the wilderness, dodging spears, arrows, swords. My life has been spared many times over. Now I'm sitting here as a king. Just sitting there and reflecting on where his life could have gone, David is realizing, this is so good. God, you've been so good to me, and I'm seeing the promises fulfilled right in front of me. You know, you sit and look at the promises of God in your own life, and you see and you categorize how they have been fulfilled one after another after another. You will start to feel. You will have the emotions. They are there. And when you see the the tenderness of God, the love of God, and how good he's been. It will inspire emotion. Yes, it will. To be able to experience God from following him. Some people say, well, I haven't felt anything for God for months, maybe even a year. Well, I'm not a doctor, but I have a hypothesis, is that you aren't taking any risks. Well, I sit there and, you know, I get my Bible open and stuff. That's not risky. There's nothing risky about that. Well, you know, I pray sometimes. That's not a risk. It's not risky. Well, you know, I show up around other Christians and stuff. Okay, that's good. Great. Where's the part where you're actually following God? As one person said, you spell faith, R-I-S-K. And when you do that, all of a sudden you start to see very quickly God coming through, and you wouldn't believe the emotions. Years ago, my buddy Derek, he was up here in Columbus, and we went on a beach vacation about 10 hours away by car. He was in prayer. It's not an audible voice or anything, but he had the distinct impression, you need to get on a plane, you need to go on that beach vacation, and you need to lead that agnostic, your buddy, Gavin, to Christ. So he shrugged it off. He's just like, that's crazy. I don't have the money to do that. And why would I come for 2 days? Why would I do that? That's stupid. He couldn't shake it. Finally, we're sitting there at the beach. I look over. There's Derek. What are you doing here? It's Thursday, you know? He went right for my buddy Gavin. And Gavin was like, what are you doing? He's like, I felt like God told me that I need to come here and I need to lead you to Christ. And Gavin said, okay. And they went on a walk down the beach. And all I know is this. It was a 45-minute walk. And when Gavin and Derek left, Gavin was an agnostic. And when Gavin and Derek returned, Gavin was a Christian. These are the kind of things that you don't experience in the safety of your bedroom. Okay? Like when God is calling on you to take a step and to step out in faith. These are the things that you never forget. Once God takes you to a place like that once, you never want anything else for the rest of your life. Yeah, David also desired God to lead his life. He was constantly inquiring of the Lord, like, should I do this? Should I do that? These times of prayer, when you talk to God and you say, God, I'm sitting before you here. Please direct me. What should I do next? And in a sense, I guess what I'm saying is, you're handing over the reins, and you're saying, I want what you want. And when God directs you through his word, through advice, people sometimes, prayer, all of a sudden he'll lead you in a certain way, and then you see that come to fruition. I've got a journal that just goes on for page after page after page of answers to prayer just like this. And I can't get through that without getting emotional. Yes, the emotions are there. Our job is to sit in front of God and to accept it and to say, yeah, I want it. I want to be part of the action. I want to see you come through. And David also enjoyed being with God's people. 30,000. Why did he have to bring that many out there? All of Israel. They had to be there. The entire congregation. Because David loved being with God's people. That's why. Some people will say, well, I just don't feel very emotional. I get it. I'm a hermit. That's what my buddy calls me. Are you hermiting? And I'm like, When you're alone and, you know, you sit at home all the time and you don't ever get around other people, fellow believers, what are you expecting? Are you expecting there's going to be that one episode on the, you know, Netflix that is really going to change your emotional state? Are you serious? Scientists have been studying that for decades. They've never found that episode, all right? It's never happened. It's never going to happen. But this past week, we're sitting around with our men's group Friday night. Had kind of a rough week. We're sitting there, and some of the guys start telling jokes. And should I share this? Yeah. One guy brought smelling salts. Not bath salts, smelling salts. So I don't know why. And then we put on a Thrasher movie after that, and, you know, we're yelling at the screen, and my wife texted me and was like, can you be quiet? It's 1:30 in the morning. You know? I was like, I'm sorry. But I remember just sitting there. It was like a rough week, and I was sitting there with the guys, and I just had this distinct thought. Man, I love every single one of these guys. I wouldn't be anywhere else right now, right here. I love this. Yeah, enjoying being with God's people, sitting at home, bitter, judgmental, in your head, is an unhealthy state to be in. And no wonder you're not feeling anything for God. You're not around his people. This is where we get that relational love, moving back and forth. And it's very exciting. It's very happy. Well, finally, what can we learn from the example of Michal? Don't be Michal. That's the example we should learn. It began with her being aloof and standing at a distance. Huh. That can't be an accident. Looking from a distance at all. Everyone else was excited, happy, enjoying themselves. And the further she was, the more she was despising David. Wonder what that means for us today. When you stand back and you're the wallflower, you don't want to participate, you don't want to talk to people. I know some of us, like myself, are introverts. I get it. You can talk to one or two people. Try. Give it a try. Push yourself. But to stand back in your bedroom and look through the window at what's happening, this leads to a sense of alienation, which led to a problem in her heart. She started to despise David in her heart. And so it went from there, from just judging from afar, despising in the heart, to developing this perverted narrative that he was doing something perverse and sexual with these servant girls. That didn't happen. It never happened. You know how long an ephod is? It goes down to your ankles. You'd have an easier time flashing somebody in a Carhartt or a snowsuit, okay? There was no exposure. There's no exposing. So it starts with judging from afar, and then it turns into despising, and then it's this weird, you're like, where did you come up with that? That me serving the Lord is something like weird and evil and perverse? Well, I would like to put that on your mind. If you're looking at this picture and you're saying, I don't feel anything for God, but you're looking from a distance and you're a judger and you're a cynic, you're like Michal. That's what you're like. Despising, judging, hating, accusing. Terrible. So I guess we could say, you know, there's one of two options here. What do you want your life to be? What do you want it to be? Like when you get older, do you want to just increasingly become more and more aloof, dry, just cynical, suspicious, judgmental? Or do you want to be someone who is just growing with happiness and gratitude and just that anticipation that God is moving, that you've seen it so many times before, that you're like, I know it's going to happen again. I know God's going to come through. Yeah, we're going through a dry spell. It's irrelevant, totally irrelevant. We're not going to let a cynic or a judger hold our joy hostage. But we're going to move forward, just continually growing, building up others in love.